Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So imagine a club so exclusive it has never had more than six members at a given time. And members have two things in common. They have each sat at the resolute desk in the Oval Office as the most powerful man in the country, arguably the world, and they all vie against each other for history's favor. Joining me now to discuss this private and elite President's Club are Time Magazine editors Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, authors of a new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Welcome both of you to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Nice to be here.
So exactly what is the President's Club? Is it where former and current presidents regularly meet up for drinks? Are there dark paneled walls? Is it a physical space?
Well, there is a clubhouse, though I don't think we should imagine that it's, you know, like the Deke House on campus. It's on Lafayette Square, and it was created by Richard Nixon for the use of former presidents, in this case, Lyndon Johnson. But the club is really more of an idea than just a bricks and mortar. It's a fraternity of men who have been through the hardest job in the world, all come out with scars, all come out quite certain that no one else can understand what it's like to have done that job. And so they form bonds that are both positive and negative with men who they have really nothing in common with except that fact.
A passage from the book reads, Clinton wanted to prove he was not the second coming of Jimmy Carter. George W. Bush was all about not being Clinton. Barack Obama was about not being either one. In the beginning of each new presidency, though, does the current president push the club back only to find himself reaching for it again when he realizes that he can benefit from their experience?
That's what we saw over and over and over again, going back, 60 years, is that coming into the office, everyone thinks they know how to do it. Clark Clifford said something funny about the incoming Kennedy administration. He said they all felt like history began with them. Once you've been in the job, usually pretty quickly, certainly when your first crisis hits, in Kennedy's case, the Bay of Pigs, you realize that not only do you need all the help you can get, but there is a very, very small group of people who can give you the kind of help you need most and the kind of understanding you need. And so we kept on seeing these relationships change from, rivalry and competition, often men who had campaigned against each other for the presidency, turning into allies and partners and co-sympathizers.
Is it primarily to get advice, the way the presidents actually use it, or more to just find someone to talk to who really understands what it means to sit in that chair?
I think it's both of those things, and also they turn to each other for help to actually go do missions. All of them have turned to former presidents not just for solace and for counsel, which they all need, and really don't trust anyone else quite the same way. But they have all turned to former presidents, whether it's Obama or Bush 2 or Clinton, going back to Truman, to send former presidents on to execute missions, usually overseas, that they can't do themselves.
Stories. Tell us about what you describe as the club's first dirty war.
Oh, that was extraordinary. This is sort of like the greatest political chess match ever played. It was between Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson. And what was amazing was the stakes were so high and both sides cheated. Mm-hmm. So this starts in the 1968 election. Remember, Johnson's not running for re-election. Nixon's running against Humphrey. What Johnson wants is to leave office as a great peacemaker and not have Vietnam be the legacy that just destroys him in history. And as we're in the final weeks of that campaign, and a peace deal is looking more and more promising, Johnson discovers through some very sensitive intelligence gathering that Nixon's people are trying to sabotage the peace talks. And Johnson has something of a crisis about whether he goes public with what he knows. And in the end, he doesn't. I mean, remember, it's 1968. The country had been through terrible turmoil that summer with the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And Johnson really felt that the country could not handle, an outgoing president accusing an incoming one of treason, which is the word Johnson used privately. And so he kept it to himself. But it was quite an amazing, very high-stakes showdown between the two of them. And in a way, it comes back as Nixon's in trouble over Watergate, and he goes to Johnson and he says, if you don't get your friends in the Senate to back off their investigation, I'm going to say how you illegally bugged us, Johnson says, you do that, I'll say what I learned when I illegally bugged you.
Wow. And part of that, wasn't part of that, Michael, that when the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers in 1971, Nixon pressed Johnson to join him in a bipartisan denunciation?
Oh, and to actually not only denounce this inquiry as well as the press's decision to publish them. Nixon was obsessed with what Johnson knew about his own role in the war, about how the war started. He wanted Johnson to come out and say this has just got to stop. And Nixon knew where it was leading. And Johnson drew the line there and said, you know, there's some things about protecting the presidency that I will stand with you on, but some things I can't.
Michael Duffy and Nancy Gibbs from Time Magazine, authors of the new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Listeners, we have a few minutes if you want to ask any question about the relationship between any sitting president and his predecessors, 212-433-WNYC. I guess only going back that far, right?
To Truman and Hoover.
Yeah.
We'd have to make it up if we went back further.
212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You write about Carter, who was very much involved in world affairs after his presidency, but was also seen as very difficult to work with. You even say he's kind of the black sheep of the President's Club.
Well, every club needs one. It sort of binds the other members together. And, you know, Carter is tricky. Next September will become the longest serving former president. It really was a second career for him. And in a way, he has shown the others just how powerful the role can be. They all found him useful in different ways because of his relationships with foreign leaders and would send him on pretty sensitive diplomatic missions to places like North Korea or to Haiti. Problem is, Carter has a way of, you know, going off script. And so they had to, you know, in Obama's case, have him basically swear an oath that he would not talk to the press about a mission that Obama had sent him on.
And, of course, you know, Obama had essentially inked a similar deal with Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton comes in, when Obama comes in and Hillary Clinton is named Secretary of State. The Obama White House or the transition team essentially has to forces Bill Clinton to sign a memorandum of agreement that's 9 or 10 pages long, restricting his movements, who he gets donations from. The Obama White House has been very I wouldn't say legalistic about the club. They've worked with them, but only under very defined circumstances.
So, for example, who has President Obama reached out to among the former presidents, and for what?
Well, I think the most interesting relationship has been his with George Herbert Walker Bush, who's the oldest member of the club at the moment. They really worked 41, as he's known. They reached out to him the minute Obama comes in. They try to get him to Washington to come to events. Bush says, I don't really want to come. They finally arrange a meeting in Texas. Obama goes down there and just lauds 41's approach to government, which is, of course, much more moderate than the second Bush's. And Bush pays him back, has twice visited him in the White House while he's in Washington. It's all done quietly, secretly. There are a few pictures, but neither side made a big deal out of it. And I think what Bush does for Obama is that he just keeps him – in some ways just, you know, goes in and tells jokes. I mean, they tell stories together.
How about President Obama and his predecessor, President George W. Bush? Bush was just in the news recently. There was a little Bush sighting, but most of the coverage was about – how low he continues to lie, unlike Dick Cheney, by the way, who is not reticent at all about criticizing President Obama.
That's right. That's the difference between a president and a vice president. President George W. Bush is a very careful monitor and abider by the rules of the club. And one of them is about supporting what he promised Obama he would do when they met during the transition, is we want you to succeed. All of us who have been in this office understand that the office is more important than the individual. And so he went completely silent. And when he has spoken out at all, as he did last week, it's to say, I don't think it is good for our country to be undermining our president, I don't intend to do so.
And that's, of course, different with Cheney, who has shown no hesitation to do so.
He could also support him and not undermine him that way, but I guess he's not choosing to do that. Right. Nancy Gibbs, Michael Duffy from Time, author of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Tell us about the creation. And the way you frame it, it was by two men in 1953 who really should have loathed each other.
And, you know, absolute political and personal opposites, Herbert Hoover and Harry Truman. And you know, these two men had nothing in common except for the fact that when Truman suddenly found himself as president in 1945, he was facing a disaster in post-war Europe, and he understood that Herbert Hoover was one of the only men on the planet who understood how to solve a problem that complex, and called him up and invited him back to the White House for the first time, you know, in 13 years. And the two formed this extraordinary partnership to do European reconstruction. Truman sent Hoover 50,000 miles around the world, meeting with heads of state and trying to arrange to get food from countries that had it to countries where people were literally starving. Truman was so grateful for his help, he renamed the Hoover Dam as the Hoover Dam because Roosevelt had changed the name. Wow. Truman changed it back.
I didn't know that.
And so there on the platform at Ike's inauguration, Hoover walks over, greets Truman, says, "I think we should form a president's club." And Truman says, "Great, you be the president, I'll be the secretary." And there it was.
We see this over the years, Brian, where presidents of different parties have actually been managed to come together and do more things sometimes than presidents in the same party. Reagan and Nixon tussled for 20 years, longer in some ways. Carter and Clinton were never a dream team. Whereas you have Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter doing 25 years worth of projects across all kinds of things. And of course,
you have Lyndon Johnson pulling Eisenhower in to consult about the war, you know, again and again and again, sending, you know, briefers down to Gettysburg to brief him and make sure he was fully informed about the progress of the fighting.
212-433-WNYC and John in Paramus. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to know the relationship between Carter and Reagan since the hostages were freed the day he was inaugurated. How did that cause a rift for them for the rest of their lives or what?
Well, I think by the time that that day came, Carter was so complete. He'd been defeated for 2 or 3 months. Carter was so focused on getting them back. Reagan barely came into it, although Reagan did, of course, fly Carter on an Air Force One-like plane over to meet them. Otherwise, Carter had very little contact with Reagan during Reagan's first term or any time thereafter.
You write about the Bay of Pigs and how that enraged U.S. allies abroad and shook Kennedy's confidence as a new president, 1961. How did the club help a young Kennedy do damage control?
Well, the single most valuable photograph that the Kennedy White House could possibly have was the picture that was on the front page of the papers of Kennedy and Eisenhower walking side by side on the paths of Camp David. Kennedy invited Ike to Camp David for the first time, and they sat down and talked about how the mission had gone wrong and what Kennedy had learned. And Kennedy freely admitted, "This job's a lot harder than I thought." And Eisenhower said, "Yep, I tried to warn you."
Yeah, that's the thing, is that Ike's people really tried to warn him not to reorganize the White House. Kennedy's folks ignored Ike's advice and then, in a way, paid a price for that for ignorance.
So you've got these wonderful stories that you've been telling of ex-presidents helping sitting presidents, but they also vie with each other in a way for history's favor, right?
Oh, it's something that those of us who've not been president, that's most of us, almost can't imagine. Once they leave office, and Brian, they're leaving office younger and younger. This group is a relatively young group of presidents, particularly right now. They now have long careers of not just figuring out what to do with the rest of their lives, but sort of protecting their own legacies, whitewashing them in some cases. And so these men, as much as they help and respect each other, also vie for who the public likes, how history will remember them. Each has their own, you know, sort of idiosyncratic machine, fog machine around him to sort of retell the story for the next 20 years. Reagan really pioneered this, you know, fog machine, but the others have picked up on it. The Carter, you know, Clinton good works model is all about, you know, in many ways, burnishing the reputations in addition to doing good work.
You want to talk about how Reagan invented that fog machine, as you call it?
Well, it's not really in the book, but I think that after he, you know, Reagan's post-presidency was one of the strangest ever because after a couple of years, he simply went off the grid. He got Alzheimer's and you know, he wrote a not very interesting memoir and then got sick. So the men and women around Reagan, and there were many, decided that this was a project, you know, that would be worth undertaking. And they have worked very, very hard over the last 20 years, publishing his speeches, his writings, his musings. And someone just published a book of notes by Reagan, literally just jottings, and all aimed toward showing, and there's some truth to this, that he was a more substantive guy than people realized at the
time. Do you think that is at all the reason that any Republican candidate for president has to hold Ronald Reagan up as sort of the ultimate model, or would that have happened anyway?
I think it would have happened anyway. I think that Reagan comes off in a lot of those books and writings as far more thoughtful and moderate than where the GOP is now.
When Clinton became president, he was joined by five former presidents at the club: Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush Sr. And you describe this as the golden age of the President's Club.
The only other time there were six members was when Lincoln took office. And that was because Lincoln's predecessors were sort of such an anemic bunch that none of them had managed a second term. And so it was really only Bill Clinton who had five rather vigorous, energetic, eager to engage members. And he reached out to and found uses for all of them, all in different ways, different directions, and some very unlikely pairings. He would talk to Richard Nixon late at night about China, about, you know, the Russia, but also about how to organize his day and use his time and stay ahead of his inbox. And, you know, how does a president just manage to cope with the demands of the job?
And didn't they all stand for a photo op one time against medical marijuana?
I don't recall that.
They did a photo op about NAFTA. They were all together. There were a couple moments where he had a bunch of them in. Uh-huh.
Surprise me if they were all against medical marijuana, but I don't recall the photo.
I could be wrong about that. Mm-hmm. But I thought there was a moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll check.
So 20 seconds. How will readers see the American presidency differently after reading your book?
Well, I think chiefly they will see that this is a job that scars these men and, as a consequence, binds them across party.
Time Magazine editors Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy are authors now of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. You can meet these authors, by the way, at noon on Tuesday, May 1st, at the 92nd Street Y's Downtown Center in Tribeca. For more information, visit 92y.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.